Good evening. I'd like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today is February 27th, 2023. Let the record reflect that it is 6 p.m. Today we have present Representative McKay, Representative McCabe, Representative Allard, Speaker Tilton, and myself, Chair Carpenter. Let's see. Anybody else in the room joined us that are legislators? Not yet. Okay, thank you for joining us. I would like to remind committee members and members in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff that are assisting us tonight will be Sunita St. Clair with the House Records and Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO. My staff's Kendra Broussard will be the committee aide. We have two items on tonight's agenda. We get to these as quickly as possible. Tonight, we're going to be continuing our discussion on Alaska's economy and learning about a couple opportunities for improving fiscal stability and economic growth. And I would just like to let the record reflect that Representative Groh has joined us at one after. We'll be hearing first from Ocean Pasture Restoration and then from the Department of Natural Resources about carbon management opportunities that are before other committees in the body. I would like to invite gentlemen forward. If you'll please come forward and put your names on the record, and we'll begin your presentation here. Okay, while they're getting this set up, I'll just introduce CEO Russ George and Vice President Ted Crookston are here to give their presentation about their company, Ocean Pasture Restoration, the noun, about what I would call a verb, which is ocean pasture restoration, and the potential economic impacts for Alaska. So, gentlemen, if you would put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
My name is Russ George, and I've been at this for my whole life, about 50 years now. So I'm excited about doing this project here in Alaska. I'll let my partner, Ed Crookston, who's more than 50 years fishing in the Cook Inlet as a commercial fisherman and one of the investors in the company. So, you know, when the fishermen come to your company and they say, we want this to happen, and they're putting their own the equity money in, that makes a big impression on me.
Yes, like was said, my name is Ted Crookston, and I came to Alaska in 1964, just on the heels of the Good Friday earthquake. That would be about 59 years ago, this coming month. I was just a little boy at the time. I was just 7 years old. And my father at that time followed his dream, and we wound up becoming very definitely engaged and established in the commercial fishing business at that time. And I grew up doing it from then throughout my whole life. So that involvement now spans about four generations in our family. And during that time, you know, my experience was really marked for the bulk of the time by a hallmark of abundance and availability and productivity. I've seen everything go from pre-limited entry era to the creation of the Commercial Entry Commission, and I've seen the changes in markets, the changes in technology, but it was fundamentally the issue that there was an abundance and there was availability, and it was a great life. But about 10, 15 years ago, we noticed just a real distinct shift, and I, for one, have lived through and still currently am the heart-wrenching experience of seeing this resource get incur a lot of loss in the disappearance of these king salmon in particular, and so I became really concerned and alarmed about my legacy and what I'd been involved with, and started looking for possible solutions, what could be done. I became very active in some of the fishing organizations, was a member of the board of directors on for a couple of stints, and joined all of them, and then I got really involved with the Department of Fish and Game, and all the biologists, and the Board of Fish, and the NOAA officials. And the one thing that really stood out was that everybody would universally say, well, there seems to be something going on in the ocean. We don't have any real good understanding of what's going on in there. And we don't really know what to do about it, even if we did know. And that was really disheartening and frightening. But I did learn, it became very clear that there was not going to be a solution by way of regulation. There wasn't going to be any good come from all this finger pointing and this chaos that came from trying to squabble over everything, and that fundamentally there had to be a problem or a solution that addressed the real problem. And so it was in about 2016 is when I first read about Russ George's efforts in the Gulf of Alaska in the year 2012. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, but that captured my attention, and I became involved in learning about it, made association with him. I've been involved with him ever since, and a few years ago I jumped in, full time with this, because it became clear to me as my understanding grew that this really held the solution to what was happening.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkston. One second, I want to make sure that the record let it reflect it. Representative Gray joined us about 6:03. And then please continue with your presentation.
So really, I just want to state here that we're coming to the legislature and authorities in both federally as well as departments of the state, because we realize that we can't do this work in a vacuum. We need transparency, we need disclosure, and we need collaboration. And so that's what we're here to seek with you. There are some specific things that we'll talk about more about what can be done to help us by way of supporting a resolution that's in the process, by way of helping us define how a private-public partnership can be arranged between us and the state. And there's some federal legislation that we've been instrumental in introducing that can be supported. And so that's the type of support that we're looking at is that. So I want to just now turn the time over to Russ George. I will say that he's got a extensive, long history in environmental work and in science work, and he brings just a wealth of experience and information to what we're to present to you here tonight. So
thank you very much. Can you make sure that the microphone is near? It'll slide over towards you too. Okay. That way folks that are online can hear you.
Is it working?
Yep. Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Well, once again, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Russ George. I was born in Boston, grew up in the American West, ended up working in Canada half of my life. I have children and grandchildren in the USA and children and grandchildren in Canada. So I'm sort of a little bit everywhere in the North American continent. But I've been doing what I call eco-restoration projects my whole life. I founded the second largest tree planting company in Canada back in 1972, which has gone on to plant about 500 million trees across Canada. So I had all the tree karma anyone could ever use. And I'm an ocean guy. So I discovered this concept that the oceans are suffering, and I'll just... So I've been working on this since, really, I had an introduction to the founder of this back in 1989, a guy named John Martin, who made a famous quote. He said, the oceans are collapsing, the plankton is collapsing in the ocean. And the plankton, and in 1989, he said, the biggest problem in the world was global warming. But we could fix that if we could fix the plankton problem. And he'd worked a lifetime uncovering that, and he had the solution. And so, but for whatever reason, it's a slow process. So here we are in 2023, still slugging away. And what we know we can do is bring fish back to Alaska, salmon in vast numbers. We know that Alaska's fishing community is one out of four jobs here in Alaska. We know that our work has been proven to be safe and sustainable. What we have to prove is that it's economically successful, and we're going to do that as a for-profit private sector company. And the way we make profit we don't own the salmon that we bring back, but we can own the carbon offsets. So when Governor Dunleavy, switched to last summer when I talked to him, he wasn't very interested in this because he saw it as climate change. But now he's had an epiphany and he sees that there's an incredible amount of money pouring into carbon offset programs, carbon capture programs. Well, our work will capture every year tens to hundreds of millions of tons of carbon dioxide from the ocean and turn it into phytoplankton, the grass of the ocean pasture, and the fish, everything up the food chain. And we're actually working on it now. We opened an office in Kenai last spring, and we're doing our intensive science work and our politicking, right, and meeting with communities. So, here's a slide from the US DOE called Energy Earthshots. I just picked this up because the important number is that $100 a ton number down on the bottom of the slide. So the US government has said carbon capture is an initiative said where we want technologies to be invented that can produce carbon offsets for less than $100 a ton. Well, about 2 weeks ago, the DOE released an ARPA-E grant for $45 million to develop the specific hardware technologies to measure carbon capture in the ocean, right? So this is being followed through big time by the federal government. Biden's, Inflation Reduction Act has several $100 billion in it for climate change related things, and carbon capture is what they're leading on. And the Paris Treaty specifies our work, that we make blue carbon, which is specified in the Paris Treaty as when you grow a plant life in the ocean, just like growing a tree on land, the plants take up carbon dioxide and park it in that living plant. And that's a carbon offset credit. It's a tree credit if it's in a Sitka spruce sitting outside the window here. It's a blue carbon plankton credit if it's in the ocean. And so a lot of people don't understand is the ocean, where on earth is all the carbon on this blue planet? Well, 94% of all the carbon on this planet is located in the oceans. Only 2% is in the air, and only 4% is in the land. So if you want to have influence in that system, it's easier to have influence in a 94% system than a 2% system, right? It's just you don't need as much traction there. So here's the ocean pasture regions that we've defined in Alaska. These round dots are approximately the scale of the projects that we've done in the past. It's 100 kilometers in diameter. They grow to be, they start out at about 10,000 square kilometers. They grow to about 30 to 50,000 square kilometers. The ocean turns from blue to green when we complete our work within a few days. This is new real estate for Alaska. These aren't the exact location, but these are more or less the scale and kind of rough locations. That would add 50% of additional land, productive land area to the state of Alaska if we start working with this kind of region. So it's got to be something good. It's a nature-based technology. Mother Nature keeps her plankton growing by sending dust to the ocean. Pastures on land, grass grows in mineral soil. When it rains, the pasture is well healthy. When it doesn't rain, we call that a drought. The pasture dies. Nobody says a pasture on land that suffered from a drought has been over-harvested of livestock when the animals aren't there. They say the pasture can't support the livestock, the animal life. So this work has been worked on for more than 50 years by federal funding, research R&D funding, and it's proven to work. Here's the natural system that we know. So the picture up on the top with the volcano erupting is an Aleutian volcano called Kasatochi. In 2008, Kasatochi erupted in mid-August. For a few days out of that, most of the eruption, the ash blew into the Bering Sea. For a few days, it drifted to the south and east into the central Gulf of Alaska. It was very late in the year, so the pasture that dust fertilized, that dust helped the plankton grow, help the last of the fish that reached the pasture, right? Because it was late in the year. But the very last big population of salmon that reached the Gulf of Alaska are the Fraser River sockeye from British Columbia. They spend 2 years at sea. So in 2010, when the Fraser River sockeye were forecast as only to arrive at Vancouver, numbering 1 million, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court had been given the task to form a special salmon commission, just the Cohen Salmon Commission, because they were going to declare that if the forecast of only 1 million sockeye arrived in Vancouver to the Fraser River, it would be a disaster, and they might need to declare the fish a endangered species. Unbeknownst to all the scientists, myself included, who were giving sworn testimony to Justice Cohen in the court, the Cassatoche had turned the ocean from blue to green. And when the sockeye arrived, while the court was in session, 40 million fish swam home into the Fraser River, equal to the largest catch return in all of history.
Right. I just have to say here, as a commercial fisherman at Cook Inlet in 2010 and 2011, we had unprecedented and unexpected huge returns. We were bowled over this, and in talking with the authorities, they said, "We don't know. Must have been something good out in the ocean." That was our experience.
So these other two pictures, you know, the one on the with the beautiful sunset there is a dust, red dust blowing out of Australia towards New Zealand that happened a number of years ago. When the dust landed in the ocean turned from blue to green. There were record catches of fish for several years thereafter. The iceberg floating there in the green water collects the snow that turns into an iceberg, accumulates for thousands of years before the iceberg breaks off into the sea. So it accumulates thousands of years of dust. What color is the water surrounding the iceberg, right? It's green. That's due to the iron-rich dust in the iceberg. And the problem why the dust isn't arriving in our pasture is because high CO2 makes plants grow on land better. And everybody thinks that's a wonderful thing, unless you're an ocean form of ocean life that needs dust to fall on an ocean pasture, which is the equivalent of rain to fall on a terrestrial pasture. And so now in today's world, high CO2 is making the grass grow on land way better every year. More dust, more grass growing means less dust blowing. And it represents a collapse of the ocean pastures. So here's a picture of the primary source of dust for our Alaskan ocean pastures is the Gobi Desert. This is a picture. I just found this 2 days ago. It popped up in the news. This is a time series of 20 years of showing the greening of the Gobi Desert. And you can see that red dust, and it's red because it has iron in it, has now been completely suppressed. Right, so more grass growing, less dust blowing. That means the ocean here is in a drought of dust. So what do we do? You know, we need to take some dust back to sea. When did we start working on this? We recognized in the U.S. that we had a crisis in the 1970s of the collapsing plankton in the world's oceans. So this is a picture of the first ocean pasture satellite that was put in orbit in 1978. To gather data on this problem, and the pretty colored picture at the bottom is the data that satellite shows where it's green and where it's not green. So since 1978, we've been pouring the money into this subject, and we've learned a lot, right? So here's how we do it. We've learned that if we take some dust back to the ocean will come back to life. So in 2012, I took 100, myself and my village company, I'm associated with the village of Old Masset in the Haida Gwaii, Haida Village, 850 people. They came to me and they said, "How do we bring the fish back? And can we restore the pasture?" And I said, "Well, I think we can." The village put up $2 million, and National Research Council of Canada put up about the same amount of money. Federal government gave us tax credits. We ultimately spent about $5 million. We mixed red muddy water on the deck of a boat, put it in the ocean, 250 miles offshore of Haida Gwaii, right on the Alaska border, Canada border. Within 2 days, the ocean turns from blue to green. And we all know that green water here close to shore is good, healthy water. It's still got good populations of fish and seabirds and things. Out at sea, that's the color the water needs to be. It's all about taking a little bit of dust to replace the dust that's gone missing in the wind. Here's the result of our 2012 experiment with a village of, sponsored by a village of 823 people. All right. So the result was, because we targeted pink salmon, which have a 2-year life cycle. When we restored the pink salmon pasture off Haida Gwaii in the summer of 2012, the pink salmon, when they swam out to sea, instead of mostly starving, were treated to a feast, and they survived and they thrived. And the very next year, they swam into the rivers and streams all throughout Alaska and Canada and the Pacific Northwest in the largest catch of salmon in all of history, right? And so those are our fish, right? And the circles and arrows below show this. This is a chart going back to 1975 of the Alaska salmon catch. And that pattern there that's in the circle shows that the pinks are high. And then because they're a 2-year life cycle fish, it repeated, right? But it eventually declined. We were unable to continue the project to take care of the pasture every year. But now that's our plan. Now we're set up to do a private sector. We want to take responsibility for these ocean pastures and bring them back to the historic level of life and abundance. And if we can earn money through blue carbon, through carbon offsets, that will pay for everything. So I'll go quickly here. This is, the big problem on this planet is that we've already put 2 trillion tons of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's in all of the yesterdays, right? People who want to stop emission reduction always want to forget about yesterday's emissions, right? But the climate change community says we have to capture some of that old carbon. So this is the opportunity. We can capture. We don't stop tomorrow's emissions, but we can capture yesterday's emissions and put it to good work, turn it into fish and turn it into money. We have proprietary technologies that we've been developing on this. I did my first experiment in 2002. It was written up in the journal Nature in January of 2003. So a good way to get yourself launched in a good science career is to get published in Nature, right? So each year, each one of our Alaska ocean pastures will capture somewhere between 10 and 100 million tons of CO2 and put it to good use, right? Turn it from poison into life itself, right? What could be better? That CO2 in the ocean, if we don't convert it to life, it will become acid, right? H2O plus CO2 gives you H2CO3, which is acid, which makes our soft drinks tart and tangy. But it kills ocean life. The only way to neutralize it is to neutralize it with photosynthesis. And it's very efficient. It's a million times the efficiency of putting a base. Like you can't, if we wanted to put, neutralize a million tons of CO of ocean acidification, we would need a million tons of limestone into the ocean. It's a one-to-one process. If iron, which feeds the which is the micronutrient that feeds the ocean plankton, has a 1 million to 1 leverage ratio. So 1 ton of iron captures a million tons, actually 3 million tons of CO2. So it's a spectacular leverage. So this is where we can make our money as a for-profit company, is on the blue carbon. And since we're an Alaskan company, we operate with Alaskan employees, we're going to pay Alaskan corporate taxes. Here's the twist. We want the state of Alaska to state that the pastures that Alaska salmon swim out to and must find healthy, in a healthy condition, are a state resource. And even though they're far outside in the open ocean, the salmon are Alaskan salmon. They're due to come back to Alaska. National Academy of Science did a 350-page report on this last year, said it's absolutely lawful and legal. And so now there's quite a rush going to market to promote this. There's a new Ocean Restoration Act that's the final draft went to the House in Washington last week. There's our OPR resolution here. But, we want to do a branding deal with Alaska where we offer Alaska the same mineral royalty that they would charge if we were an oil company. We'd be happy to pay that 12.5% royalty for branding rights because the Alaska brand guarantees that we are compliant with the terms of the Paris Treaty, right? Which means the international markets are open to us. So it's not entirely a charitable act for us. We really want that. We want that branding rights. Here's what we think we'll see from just one pasture. And we think ultimately we'll be doing five or more pastures every summer in Alaska. If we do 100 million tons of carbon capture in the pasture, which is very plausible, fits with the data. And if we use Biden's number, DOE's number of $100 a ton, that's a $10 billion revenue stream. If we pay our 9.5% corporate tax to the state of Alaska, that's $950 million of corporate tax to the state of Alaska every year. If we pay the 12.5% royalty, that's another $1.25 billion. And in 2014, when our miracle pink salmon run of 2013 was reported by Fish and Game here in Alaska, they said that the value of the miracle pink catch of 2013 delivered a $600 million economic stimulus into the state economy. So we think that that's repeatable every year from now until forever. So that's our real proposition. And we're going to do that by investing. We're putting $20 million into our project over the next 3 years. We were hoping to get out to sea this summer in a big way, but we're probably going to be out the summer in a more of a small way this year. But the following 3 years, we'll be out doing our repeat of our HIDA experiment, which we're certain will work. We're looking to form a public-private partnership agreement with the state. That might just simply be around the royalty agreement. Right? We have to prove that this works. So we have to prove it's environmentally safe, it's ecologically sustainable, and for us, we have to prove it's economically successful. And so that's why we're going to do this 3 years, three pastures in a row, so that everybody can see that it's working. And verification and certification of, you know, doing this as a form of carbon that's compliant with the Paris Treaty makes it the best value carbon on the planet, right? So, and we're just going to continue doing this year in and year out. It's not something you can do once, right? It's like, you know, 10,000 years ago, humans discovered if we took care of pastures, they'd take care of us, right? And so everybody in the world of pasture management today knows they have to take care of the pasture every year. And the Alaska Ocean pastures have to be taken care of every year from now until the end of time, right? And fortunately, 50 years of publicly funded research, right, starting back in the 70s, has given us the know-how on how to do this. It's not like we're starting fresh, right? We're basic, and eventually all science you have, if you do science for just research, it's academic. When you convert research science into activity, they call that technology, right? So we're out to do version 2.0. We did version 1.0 of the technology in 2012. Now we're going to roll out version 2.0 here in Alaska. So these are our asks for you guys, right? Senator Peter Machicki last year was writing on an OPR Alaska resolution that he was going to put through. It kind of got stalled. He retired. Jesse Bjorkman has picked it up, and so it's going to go back into the Senate, and we've also had some support here with House members. We'd like it to go be a House resolution. Unbeknownst to most people, there is a Republican Party is really big in support of this in Washington, D.C., so we have spectacular support from the Republican Party, who are introducing the Ocean Restoration Act as we speak. right? And it's an act with appropriations, and there are more Republicans backing it than Democrats, but there's enough Democrats that we've got bipartisan and bicameral support, so it's going to go through both the House and the Senate. We want this public-private partnership, which we think we can work on that with the state. There's this salmon cost recovery program that the hatcheries receive the ability to get to be given a quota of fish to recoup their costs. We'd like to be made eligible for salmon cost recovery, as we can prove that we're bringing fish back. If the state and the feds give us a quota that covers our costs, that would be a perfectly reasonable thing. Doesn't require an appropriation from anybody, right? It's an in-kind payment in the fish. And then we are going to be the number one carbon capture and storage technology, both in the United States but also in the world, because we're rolling out our work all around the world, right? So we have OPR Alaska, which is our kind of centerpiece, because Ted's from Alaska, I'm from the Pacific Northwest. We've done it here. We know it works here. We love salmon because when you hire a salmon scientist to go study an ocean pasture, the salmon scientist swims home, and the body of the salmon is the data that proves that it worked, right? So, people ask me how many scientists I had on my 2012 project. I said, well, I had 175 million pink salmon scientists that reported in. So we're pretty excited about this and very excited to be here. So I'll open it to questions now.
Thank you, Mr. George. Would you take a step back to one of the first slides? And I'm thinking about the one that's the big picture with the circles for the ocean pastures, and just step us through what a pasture is.
Well, okay, so ocean pastures, Mr. Chair, are an eddy feature that's in the ocean. So as of about 2014, we had satellite resources in space that would allow us to see very structure out in the ocean off the continental shelf, which are very large eddies. And so fish, everybody knows if you go fishing in a river, you want to fish in the back eddy behind a rock to catch a fish, because fish naturally gravitate to the eddies and they point their nose upstream and they let the food come to them. And it's a nice, comfortable life. And the ocean is full of these very big, slow-moving eddies that are in the neighborhood of 100 to 150 kilometers in diameter. And the fish go there. My hypothesis, which is very different than the traditional academic salmon hypothesis, is that the fish all go offshore. Most of the salmon go offshore as quickly as they can because the inshore water on the continental shelf is still rich and healthy, which means it's full of predators. And so if you're a salmon smolt, right, you need to get out of that predation zone. And so they go offshore, and they need to find these eddies. And if the eddies are these which I call pastures, if those eddies are no longer healthy pastures, then you don't survive. And everywhere in the world, we know that that fish go to eddies, right? Our Haida project, for instance, when the eddy bloomed, we had vast schools of albacore tuna arrive in the eddy, right? Well, you don't expect to see the water white with white water, with jumping albacore tuna here in the Gulf of Alaska. Yeah. But they knew the eddy was blooming and it was growing. We saw whales that were too numerous to count. We were a scientific expedition. We had a research ship. I had 12 people on board. We couldn't count. We couldn't keep track of the whales we could see. We had V-shaped formations of Canada geese landing in the ocean 300 miles offshore. Never been recorded in the textbooks that Canada geese will go out offshore and land. So when the eddies bloom, everything comes to the bloom, right? And so these green dots that I've put here pretty much are at scale, right? The size of the eddies. The eddies are all offshore. They're beyond the continental shelf. So nothing we do can harm anything, any life on shore, right? And we can't run all the eddies. We have to do pasture rotation. You know, so like if you're managing wildlands, wildland pastures on land, you can't intensively manage that pasture year after year. You know, you manage it this year, you let it lay fallow next year. You go back to it the year after. The ocean pastures require that same, you know, active and fallow pattern. So we have to hopscotch around, right, to do this work.
We have questions. Representative Gray.
Hi. Thank you, Chair. So I thank you for your presentation. It's very interesting, and obviously I want our fish to thrive. My question is about the carbon sequestration point. And I do understand that carbon dioxide dissolved in salt water will make carbonic acid, which is very nourishing for plants. And the plants use that carbon dioxide through photosynthesis to create carbohydrate, which is then eaten by fish. And fish, like humans, break those bonds for energy and release the waste product, which is CO2. So for it to be sequestered, it would be the amount of phytoplankton that will not be eaten by fish that would actually need to sink down to the ground. I just wanted to make sure that I understood that correctly. So in order for it to be sequestered, if it gets eaten by animals, it's not, because it's going to be released again as CO2. Correct.
Yeah. Let me answer the question. You've got it pretty much correct, right? But some of the plankton sinks to the bottom. So, you know, we use a relatively small percentage of the carbon that goes into photosynthesis as our blue carbon model, and we've done this, and that's what this ARPA E, $45 million that's just been made available is to help fine tune the instruments to make that, to work on that carbon metric, right? Because it's not enough to capture carbon, you have to put it away safely, right, for a long period of time. So pretty much the ocean science communities, the ocean sinks carbon for a vastly longer period of time than a forest. So when I ran forestry projects and we did carbon projects in Canada, coastal British Columbia, we were required to use a 50-year lifespan on the forest, right, that we would manage the carbon in 50-year chunks of time. When I did the same thing in Costa Rica in tropical rainforests, we were required to use a 35-year forest lifespan to come up with our leftover carbon that's parked, right, for a long time. The ocean has a 1,000-year carbon storage system, right? So the carbon that goes into the ocean is it's not out of the system forever, but it's a minimum of 1,000 years, right? So in the world of climate change, right, 1,000 years is pretty much, you know, good. It's more than good enough, right, compared to other terrestrial options, right? But that's why we have, the product hasn't been brought to market. So that's our business is to bring, we're like an oil exploration company, right? We know that each of these green spots is a drilling location, but we have to do the work to prove that we can bring that location into production, right, and produce that value. So that's our business question. Can we produce it in enough value and sell it to continue?
Right. Follow up, Representative Gray.
Thank you. So in my very limited understanding, I do know that iron is a limiting element for plant life. But in my limited understanding, I think it's a lot of iron that we would, and that has a cost for, you know, paying for this iron that we're going to basically sort of fertilize the ocean with. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about how much iron is required, how much that iron costs, and if there's any unintended side effects to just sowing a lot of iron across the surface of the ocean.
Okay, let me answer through the chair. Let me answer that one. One of my favorite questions. Iron is everywhere, right? It's in near shore. It's washing out of the dirt. wherever you see dirt that's tan and colored, it's 1% iron oxide, iron ore. If it's red color, like red clay, it's 3%. If you go to an iron ore mine, it's 65% iron, right? So iron, and the iron in the water right here, right, is about a part per million. But 200 miles offshore, it's about a part per trillion. So it's a million times lower concentration. Here in coastal waters, the part per million iron doesn't cause problems. It's not considered an environmental poison or a pollutant in anything. So with the Haida people, we bought $72,000 worth of mineral dust. Not much. 100 tons, right? Our target was to change the concentration of the iron in the Haida eddy 250 miles offshore from that part per trillion to several hundred parts per trillion, right? Never anywhere near what coastal water is naturally. So we will never bring the offshore ocean water to as high, even a 1/100,000th or 1/10,000th of the iron concentration that's in coastal water. And so it's profoundly safe, right? There's never, and Mother Nature does this all the time. So we've been studying plankton blooms that come from dust in the wind forever. Charles Darwin reported in the middle 1800s when he sailed the Beagle around the world that when they sailed in between Africa and South America, a dust storm fell so heavily on the boat that the sailors had to shovel dust off the boat like they were shoveling snow. And the ocean turned from blue to green, right? So iron's constantly always arriving in the world's oceans by natural sources, except that today, high CO2 makes grass grow on land better. The reason why the Gobi Desert's turning green, more grass is covering the land, is because they're planting it, but the high CO2 is an accelerant for plant growth on land. So trees and grasses and everything grow way better in today's high CO2 atmosphere, right? Tragically, that means the dust doesn't blow and the oceans are dying. And the oceans are 72% of this planet. And, yeah.
One last follow-up.
Representative Gray.
So we had the, again, I am not an expert on this, but I believe the Sahara is growing. And we did have a huge dust storm that actually brought dust to America. So maybe the Gobi has more grass, but in my limited African knowledge, the Sahara is bigger and there's dust storms there that spread dust all over the world.
Sure, there's a big program sponsored by the international aid communities called the Great Green Wall of Africa. And they're building a green wall by planting the desert south of the Sahara to limit the dust. Because when the dust blows off the land, that's topsoil, right? And so to save the topsoil so they can grow more food, the world is aggressively trying to limit the dust. Fortunately, you know, they call our work ocean iron fertilization. And I always rebel at that because it's not a fertilizer, right? Nitrates and phosphates, like your standard fertilizers, work at part per million concentrations. Iron works at part per trillion concentrations, so a million times less. So, that you can fertilize the ocean. We could go out and fertilize a pasture like we did with the Haida people with one boat, like the largest fishing boat, 138-foot fishing boat, right, trap boat, of which there's lots of them here in Alaska. We could load it up, we could load that one boat with iron, and we could bring a ocean pasture up to life. If we had chosen to take fertilizer out, we'd go to Home Depot and buy bags of fertilizer. We could do it. We could make the ocean turn green. We'd need 1 million boats to do the same job, right? So you can't do it. You can't fertilize. There are only 300,000 large boats on the planet. So the very first thing we'd have to do ocean fertilization is increase the size of the global fleet, right? So it's no small miracle that this guy John Martin unraveled this, back in the 70s and 80s.
Let me just make a comment through the chair to your question on amount. When we did 100,000 pounds in 100 square miles, you work that backwards, that's 63 miles by 63 miles. That works out to one 50-pound bag of iron in every square mile. I mean, it's just a very microscopic.
You would have a very hard time sprinkling it in the mud. Like if you walked across that area with a salt shaker, you wouldn't be able to do it. You know, you'd be, you know, that's what you could just bear. You wouldn't be able to put it thinly enough. Our challenge is putting the iron in it so dilute because the system doesn't need much. Because photosynthesis uses iron as a switch, mm-hmm. not a fertilizing nutrient. Photosynthesis will always run at a low level, but in the presence of iron, the switch is thrown, and it will run at a high level. If you add more iron, it doesn't make the high level of photosynthesis any more high. It's just a switch, just low power, high power. And that low power, high power iron switch takes place down in the parts per trillion range. That's so, hence, you know, we can afford to get one boat and not 1 million, right?
Thank you. Representative Ballard, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you. Is there any risk that these carbon efforts could undermine our resource development industry?
Well, no. In fact, you know, I just received a call today from Suncor in Alberta, right, who's the tar sands company, who are asking me to if I go and make a presentation to them because they would like to buy our carbon offsets because they'd like to make their oil green. That's the nature of carbon offsets. If oil companies are, you know, oil, you know, the world wants oil to go away, and I personally don't believe that's going to happen, right? And but a lot of the green community just wants to punish the oil robber barons or whoever, you know, whatever psychology they have going. But you know, the world of carbon offsetting, you know, offsetting emissions by doing planting a tree or bringing back the fish is it's expressly allowed in the Paris Treaty. So, you know, what the state of Alaska, all the state of Alaska needs to do, because this is in the Paris Treaty, the state of Alaska doesn't need to pass a law. Just somebody in authority. You know, the Paris Treaty says every nation that in order to be compliant with the treaty may elect to do certain things. And they've listed some of the many things that you can elect to do. And blue carbon is one of the electable procedures. So if Governor Dunleavy would say, gee, Alaska is going to offset CO2 by capturing by using the blue carbon specification in the Paris Treaty, automatically he's made the whole nation, the U.S., compliant with the requirements of the treaty.
Representative Ballard, do you have another question?
Just a little bit of clarification. Is that a no?
Yeah, it won't hurt it'll help the resource industry.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
We will have some competition from other people who produce carbon offsets, right? Because there's lots of ways to do this, and some people think, you know, you should compete against everybody who does what you do. You know, we think there's room for everybody. But
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not perceive, and I'm actually confident, I don't know as much about science as Representative Gray, who's a medical practitioner and has studied it more. I'm confident, but I have studied business plans a little bit, and I have some questions about this, and I also have some understanding of the ocean. A lot of people have thought for a while that fishing has declined in the oceans, in part in some places because of higher temperatures associated with climate change, and also because of increased pollution. And I'm somehow getting the idea, I want to make sure I understand this, that you believe it's more of a problem that not enough dust from the land has fallen in the ocean recently. Is that basically correct? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, through the chair. Yes, that's okay. Quite correct, right? The ocean, and not every part of the world is uniform, right? So downwind of the Sahara, you know, there's the ocean is high iron, right, downwind of the Arabian Peninsula, it's high in iron. But vast regions of the world's oceans are low in iron. Gulf of Alaska is what's called a high nutrient, low chlorophyll, HNLC ocean, which means there's plenty of nutrients, but not enough plant life growing. And that's entirely due to the, and it's known to be low iron, right?
Okay. My other question, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, is
Representative Grow.
Sir, why aren't more people and more entities doing this? If this is, you know, both a way to improve fishing in the oceans and increase healthy fishing and also make money.
Well, this was in 1990 when this was announced by John Martin at a big ocean conference of the world. He said, we'll dump iron in the ocean. Global warming is the greatest manipulation of nature we've ever seen. Right, but we can top that. We can put iron in the ocean and get the plankton to grow. People, he'd done the calculation. He said the entire planet is lacking only one half of one shipload, big super tanker full of iron. Right, just one half of one ship is enough to restore. And it says, you know, and here's President George Bush the first, right, in the political cartoon saying, oh, cheap, fast, and easy looks promising. Well, he went on to dedicate hundreds of millions of dollars worth of academic research to this topic. And the academic researchers keep saying, more, please. National Academy of Science just published this 350-page report last year. It says, wow, the ocean can manage carbon dioxide removal, but we need another 10 years of research, right? And I'm saying, well, wasn't 50 years enough, right, to get to start trying it at scale? So it is the government of Egypt a few weeks ago just announced that it had elected to use this as one of its major climate change commitments. The government of India has committed to do it. I was at a conference put on by the African Union in Africa before Christmas. So, and there were ambassadors from all the African coastal nations there, and we were talking about, you know, how do we bring back the fish to coastal Africa, right? Well, you need and so we think this will bring back the fish. But the World Bank is now supporting that initiative, too, because the blue carbon will provide a much needed source of revenue for those nations, right? And we've proposed this same model, right? We've said, we have companies set up in several of the African nations. Some of them, OPR Madagascar has been in operation since 2019, right? It's a slow process, and there's a lot of people who say, wow.
Yeah. Representative Groh, you have a follow-up.
Yeah, I wanted just to follow up. Sir, are there any independent academic studies that show this is safe? And I just want to point out.
Yeah, this 350-page report from the National Academy of Science makes that very abundantly clear.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
There's tons. There are hundreds and hundreds of papers that show that this is safe and reliable. Right.
Representative McKay, do you have a question?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Chair. Through the chair, and thank you for the presentation. I was just thinking, when a volcano blows, and we have that happen quite often in the Ring of Fire, do you get a lot of iron out of that, or silicon oxide?
Oh, we do. In fact, when the big Tongan volcano blew up January of last year, the ocean satellites watched the ocean turn from blue to green throughout the south where that ash plume landed.
So follow-up question, because, you know, we have that fairly often in Alaska where our volcanoes go off. And do you see that helping the situation? Or
It does. There are
There are versions of deserts, I guess, you know, that give us the...
There are four volcanoes from Alaska that have put ash into the Gulf of Alaska at the right time of year. This works. It doesn't help if you do it in the wintertime.
Oh.
When the fish aren't. What we have to do is put it on top of the. We want to We want to have a pasture, lush and healthy, that we can call a nursery pasture. So when the baby fish swim out to sea, they have a feast, right? So we need that spring, right? And you know why it works in Alaska? Everybody knows about Alaska vegetables, right? In the midnight sun, right? That's why this works really, really well in the Gulf of Alaska, because for the same reason you can grow a giant cabbage in Alaska, you can grow a giant plankton bloom on an Alaskan pasture.
Representative McKay, do you have another question?
Yeah, just really quick follow-up. I lived in Norway for a while. They had a lot of salmon farms. So just curious, what would happen if you seeded a salmon farm? You ever thought about that?
Yeah, well, through the chair, we have thought about that because we've had some flack from some salmon farmers who have said, well, wait a second, if the salmon are in such abundance that you know, in 2013, they predicted the forecasted catch was between 50 and 52 million fish. They stopped catching fish after catching 225 million. They only stopped catching because there was no longer any place in any fish plant in Alaska to receive another fish. So fish farmers say, whoa, you guys are going to mess us up if you flood the market with salmon. You know, we're not going to be able to farm them effectively.
Representative McCabe, did you have a question? Yeah. Representative Allard?
I don't like farmed salmon.
Well, this is the perfect way to grow.
How much revenue are other states are seeing from the carbon sequestration efforts? Most of them look at it as a environmental reasons.
Well, you know, California, I gave the first testimony in 2005 when the California Air Board was given the responsibility to manage carbon greenhouse gases in California. And I sat before a meeting like this and said, well, my idea is to do it in the ocean where we can have if we make a minor change in the ocean, we can solve the big problem, right? Working on land or scrubbing, you know, Bill Gates put $200 million into a direct air capture machine that was built. And that last January, they made a press release and they said, this fantastic direct air capture machine, which is a machine that scrubs CO2 out of the air, had successfully operated for a year and it had removed 4,000 tons of CO2 from the atmosphere, right? And he's getting tons of money from the DOE now to expand that. We had a phone call from a group of electrical energy industry executives in the Western U.S. from the research director for 43 large corporations on the HYDA project. And he said, where's all the tons of carbon that you that you put on the books? And I said, well, that's a good question. Why do you ask? Right? He says, because we want to buy it. And I said, well, how much do you think we had? And he said to me, well, we looked at the satellite data, and by our calculations, you have 82 million tons on your ledger. And I said, well, that's way bigger than I would have claimed, right? But we couldn't monetize it at the time. You know, we were kind of a frail company. The green movement killed us, right? The green movement attacked us. They said, you're going to allow the fossil fuel industry to be off the hook. Fossil fuel industry will be able to afford to continue to sell fossil fuel because you're going to turn all their poison CO2 into fish. Right? And so you must stop. Right?
Any other questions for the committee? We're nearing the top of the hour. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, is there any way to prevent harmful algae blooms?
Through the chair, let me, that's an easy question. Okay. The harmful algal blooms, like red tides that we know of here, red tide is actually a form of zooplankton, not phytoplankton. So number one, it's not photosynthetic, right? So they have never been reported offshore, right? We can only work offshore because we can't put iron in coastal waters because the coastal waters are already super saturated with iron. So no prescription, nobody can prescribe additional, you know, if you're not anemic, you don't need iron, right? And so, the record shows really clearly that out in these zones, there are no harmful effects. Okay. But then, but that's what we have to do. 3 years running, we're bringing venture finance in here that says we're going to prove it's environmentally safe, ecologically sustainable, and environmentally successful, and we're going to do it 3 years running. And believe me, we're going to be under a microscope, right?
Thank you, gentlemen. I think this is about the time that we have available for the presentation. I appreciate all the questions from the members here, and I appreciate your presentation. Are you available for questions afterwards if the members have extra questions either tonight or tomorrow or following days?
Yeah, through the chair. Yeah, we are here through all of this week, and we have an office in Kenai, so we're frequently there, although we're often in the lower 48. But we'd be happy to meet with any of you under any conditions here and answer more questions. Yeah. We're here to beat the drum, right? So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will have another presentation. We'll take a brief few minutes to get the slides set up. Record. Next on the agenda, we'll be hearing a presentation by the Department of Natural Resources on Alaska's carbon management opportunities. We do not currently have any bills related to carbon in this committee, but carbon being such a hot topic and a potential revenue source that's being talked about, I thought it would be good to have a conversation with the department. So with that, I would like to invite Deputy Commissioner John Crowther and Special Assistant to the Commissioner Rena Miller to begin their presentation. Put your names on the record and begin your presentation, please. Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you very much, Chair. For the record, my name is John Crowther. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and here to run through the presentation we have for you this evening. I believe your committee staff has prepared an additional slide that we presented earlier today to the House Resources Committee that we'll be happy to summarize as well about hypothetical projects and some very hypothetical revenues associated with carbon capture.
Would it be fine to have a conversation about that at the end of this presentation, or would you like to take it first?
I think we can do it at the end of the presentation. That probably gives the most context for the committee.
Okay, then please continue.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. So here is the outline of what we'll go through this evening, and just in respect for the committee's time, we'll try and be brief. The first is, at a very high level, what is carbon management? The committee just heard a presentation about a specific proposal in the carbon management space, but you know, we're here to share just at a framework level. There's all sorts of different ideas people are pursuing to affect or limit the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and environment. So the first thing we'll summarize is carbon offsets, so nature-based, where you use natural processes to sequester carbon, potentially on Alaska's lands. And then carbon capture, utilization, and storage, CCUS, where you use the geologic resources of Alaska to inject carbon dioxide underground and store it for the long term. And then we'll just do at a high level why we believe carbon management is good for Alaska. Essentially, why carbon management activities using our state's resources can bring money and wealth into Alaska, enrich Alaskans like we've used our natural resources historically, whatever kind of resources they've been. So without questions, I'll move on to the next slide. So what is carbon management? And this oversimplified cartoon you see on the left, there's a representation of a power plant. You know, that's a potential emission of carbon dioxide. Things like burning fossil fuels, different industrial processes, all put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's natural to be there, always been there. But it, just like as was described previously, there's also a natural process for carbon fixation. That's shown on the right side of the slide, where carbon is absorbed in plants, concentrated in the environment, builds up in things like grasses, trees, etc., and in the oceans. And what one of the provisions of legislation we're bringing forward, not to discuss it this evening, but we're focused on how do we make Alaska's lands available for folks who are trying to put more carbon on the landscape, trying to get more carbon in trees, more carbon in grasses, in the tundra, potentially in kelp or other offshore activities. So that's when we talk about offsets. We're trying to make Alaska's lands available for those kinds of projects. And then when we're talking about CCUS, we're talking about our underground resources, where our reservoirs, you know, we know Alaska is highly prolific and prospective for oil and gas, but those same geologic features, whether it's in depleted oil and gas reservoirs, but also in other kinds of geologic features that say store saline water, so highly mineralized or salty brine water that's, you know, deep underground, not available for drinking or utilization for other reasons, but it can receive carbon that's injected and store it in the long term. So without questions, those are the two high-level categories we'll go through.
Please continue.
And so as you can see, this is carbon management simplified. This slide shows that it's not so simple. And really what this is meant to show is that in all of these areas, you know, that we see across our state and across our country, forest and land use, general housing, waste disposal, agriculture, people are trying to assess how much carbon their activity is associated with, potentially limit it, and generate credits and trade those credits. And so the you know, the prior presenter talked about blue carbon, ocean carbon. That's a big pursuit. You can see all these other kinds of carbon credits that different businesses are trying to create. Go forward.
Please do.
So getting specifically into the carbon offsets, just to frame up the issue, we're showing a map of Alaska here. And we're presenting it as is. You know, we know we live here. We know how much Alaska has to offer. But when you look at this map, the shaded gray-blue lands on there are owned by the state, generally. Now, some of those are state parks. Some of them have other dedicated uses. A small number of them have been transferred as part of municipal entitlements to local governments. But when you look at a snapshot on the map, that's a huge amount of lands. And we want to make those lands available geologically for CCUS and in the offset context available for projects to sequester carbon. We want to throw the doors open. If you're a company, if you've got an idea, we want that land, those resources to be available to you. And we show that map to show, you know, they're all over the state. Some of them are in the interior. Some of them are way up north. Not a lot of trees up there in the offset sense. Some of them are along that coastal range, just a little bit of them in south central, more traditional, you know, rainforest type, temperate rainforest. And in our interior, we have a tremendous amount of different natural landscapes. But we want to make all of them available for these kinds of projects if the market's there, if developers are there. And next slide, in the offsets context, this slide is meant to show how much value and potential we think is out there. And so when you look here, this is a consulting report prepared by a group called the Boston Consulting Group, you know, informational consultancy that does a corporate analysis around the world, prepared for Shell, the energy company, and it talks about what the carbon markets are seeing in terms of volume, in terms of value. In 2021, on the left side of the screen, there's a reference to the compliance market. So that's areas like California where they have requirements to manage carbon. So people buy and sell those required credits there. what we're really interested in, you know, we want to become one come all, but what we're really interested in is the voluntary market, where people who, you know, different companies around the country and around the planet are voluntarily buying credits to offset their emissions. They may be doing it for corporate goals, their boards may be requiring it, investors may be requiring it. But we want to make our lands primarily available for that market. And as we can see from this slide, there's significant growth there, $2 billion in 2021. But on the right side of this slide, we see in 2022, growth in that market, the potential for 5 times of growth by 2023. And so from our perspective, if we, the state of Alaska, have tremendous natural resources, tremendous lands that are frankly not parallel to any other landowner who are participating in these markets, and we can bring them forward, and the markets are expected to see billions of dollars of growth, we can participate in that growth. And so, you know, that, you know, on the far right corner of that slide, you see $10 to $40 billion in value as one group's estimation of what the voluntary market may be worth in 2030. From the state of Alaska's perspective, we'll take 1/10, we'll take 1/100, we'll take 1/10,000 of $40 billion if we're bringing it into the state of Alaska to Alaskans.
Thank you, Mr. Crowther. We have a question from Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Mr. Crowther. Through the chair. So you say Alaska just wants to access the voluntary market. What assurances do we have that this isn't going to turn into some sort of cap and trade program? You know, once we get the framework in, once we get all started, I mean, I heat my house with a wood stove and there's smoke comes out of the chimney. And I mean, I can see a time period down the road when somebody might come to me and say, hey, you're putting wood smoke and CO2 in the atmosphere. Pony up here, buddy. You know, you need to buy some trees somewhere or something. Mm-hmm. So I want to be very clear about the difference between cap and trade and voluntary, and also very clear that the governor and UDNR is not intending to go down the cap and trade market. So maybe you could highlight the differences and give us some assurances anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Representative McCabe, through the chair, that's absolutely right. The governor is not proposing any sort of cap and trade. This bill does not include any restriction on what kind of activities can occur in Alaska. And the department has no intention of pursuing anything like that. And I think I would note for you, the California market, you know, that system that they chose to set up was imposed through their legislature. Their decisions is through their government. You know, we don't view this giving any authority for the department or any state agency to do anything like that. That would fully rest with the legislature to have any program like that. And the administration is certainly not proposing it.
Representative McKay.
To follow up on my colleague's question, thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. You know, that's fine for now. What about a future governor, a future legislature? What would it take for them to, shall we say, convert this whole thing into a mandatory cap and trade program? Complete new legislation? Is there things we can do with our current bills to make it sort of like bulletproof to prevent that from happening, because a lot of our constituents are very concerned about that possibility. Thank you.
Mr. Crowther, it may seem like he was asking you to look in your crystal ball, but assuredly that's not what we're asking. But to his point, how can we, or are the bills structured, or can we structure it in a way in which it's doesn't lead to future growth in a taxation or a cap and trade or something like that?
Yeah, so both Representative McKay and Chair Carpenter, you know, the intent of this legislation is to make these opportunities available for Alaska. And I think we've really focused the language of the legislation on, you know, we have a constitutional mandate to develop our resources. So we've focused the language of the legislation on making available our resources, land surface and subsurface, for carbon projects. But we really view there's nothing in the language of the bill that would set those lands up for, you know, on the compliance side, on the requirement that those activities be conducted. They're fully dependent on either the state developing these projects purely for the sense of generating credits and revenue, or for third parties to propose these projects. You know, I don't want to expound on constitutional law or what, you know, what powers there are, but we view this legislation doesn't give us any authority on the side of requirements from the executive branch side. And so that authority would fully remain in the legislature to set any requirements or targets like that. And so, you know, whatever future legislature may do, we don't know, but we understand that this legislation's not giving us any authority in that space. You know, we'd certainly be willing to entertain if there's considerations from the bodies about amendments to the legislation that confirm that. We'd view it as consistent with the legislation as drafted, so we wouldn't think that is an issue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Crowther. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, through the chair, Mr. Crowther. So, in the DNR's opinion, in the governor's opinion, the poor storage underneath, I forget what exactly it's called, but the storage in the aquifer, not aquifers, but the, you know, the big basins underneath at 2,600 feet and below, as well as our trees and maybe even the phytoplankton, you consider that a natural resource of Alaska for the constitutional purposes that we as a legislative body are supposed to develop those for maximum sustainable yield. Mm-hmm. So I just want to, you know, you mentioned constitutionality and that sort of stuff. We sort of have a constitutional mandate to develop these resources if, in fact, we do consider them resources.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, that's our position. That's our intent in bringing forth these bills, and I think that's a fair characterization that we recommend you developing and using these resources to the benefit of the people.
Thank you.
Representative Allard, do you have a question?
Sure. What happens if there is a claim against the state that exceeds the trust fund balance?
Yeah, Representative Allard, through the chair.
I apologize. I should have said through the chair. I'm intrigued by all this. Sorry.
Oh, certainly understand. So I think you may be speaking in the context of the carbon capture, utilization, and storage. And so under the way that that legislation is laid out, when an operator sequesters carbon, they have to pay for the right to use, if it's on state land, the state land itself. But in any event, any land type, they also have to pay a small fee over time into this carbon capture closure fund. And the intent of that fund is to cover the long-term liabilities that the state may have associated with these activities being on their lands, because one of the provisions of the legislation is once a project ends, once a project gets regulatory approval by the AOGCC to close, after a 10-year period, the state assumes title to the carbon and thus any residual liability. And so understanding your question to be about, you know, what happens if in year 11 or 12 there's an issue and the state has a liability of some kind, we have that storage trust fund to pay that liability, but in theory it could exceed it. So I think that I would say two things there. The first is that as these projects develop, the agencies will be assessing, you know, what we see in the market, what we see in Alaska, the nation, and the world about different activities associated with carbon projects. Do they have any sort of liability that seems to be developing? One of the things we can do if we do see that is change or increase the fund amounts so that projects have to match that long-term cost that they may incur. Another thing we can do, we've seen insurance markets start to develop where people pay small amounts of money to, you know, purchase insurance coverage so that that risk or liability is borne by other parties in addition to the direct holder. So we could use some of those funds in the storage trust fund to purchase insurance policies and such. And, you know, again, I don't want to cast myself because I cannot as a constitutional or state lawyer, but we do have sovereign immunity. And so the scope of claims that can be brought against the state and the suite of parties that can bring those claims is limited unless there's a cession of jurisdiction by the state. And so that might take an act of the legislature to accept even if we have that liability to accept claims against it. And I don't want to cast myself as being able to render legal opinions about those scenarios, but we think from that perspective, the liability is well protected, you know, just from the kind of theoretical framework. We also think from our observed practical sense of what the liabilities can be, you know, carbon dioxide at regular atmospheric concentrations, not hazardous. So if there's a leak of some kind from a reservoir that's gradual, you know, that doesn't present a human health risk in a general sense. We're not, you know, we the state are not incurring tax benefits to do these projects, so we don't have a tax liability if there's a back-end issue with them. And so, you know, we have an obligation if this legislation passes to continue to monitor how that liability develops in the marketplace. But right now we don't see that we would be undertaking significant state risk.
I have a question. You're welcome, Representative Allard. I have a question. I see lots of numbers here and lots of dollars. And I imagine that there's going to be some competition around the world, or at least around the United States. Not speaking specifically to the bills that the governor's introduced, but the way in which we're approaching management of this carbon market growth within the state. How does it compare to other jurisdictions and how other places, other states are dealing with this issue?
Yeah. So thank you, Chair Carpenter. So from an offset perspective, you know, we're seeing some other public jurisdictions dip their toe into the space, I think is a fair characterization. You know, we've seen, I think in Washington State, in Michigan State, projects in a few local government in this public land space do projects in the order of 10, 100,000 acres of land. Kind of pilot scale projects that are generating offsets, generating revenue for those communities. What we think Alaska brings uniquely to the table in that offset space is millions of acres. Now, it may not all be forested. It may not all be high value forestry, but there's very few other landowners, public or private, in the United States who can do a project on a million acres of land. You know, our Alaska Native corporations have been so successful in this space because they're some of the largest private landowners in the entire country. And so I think we think our scale really just brings a unique value. And, you know, that opens up new kinds of projects potentially. You know, these are very hypothetical, but, you know, at the scale of a million acres of forest fire, there's no other landowner in the U.S., very few, who can say, we want to bring a conglomeration of companies to reforest a forest fire area. That's a thing that we think Alaska could uniquely bring to the market. So consequently, there's not other people doing those kinds of projects at our scale who can show us, well, this is the economics, these are the costs, this is the timeline. But we think it's at least worth opening that door and investigating.
Interesting. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carpenter. So, Mr. Crowther, another huge issue of great concern. So when we're talking about offsets and we're talking about land that Alaska owns, is it the governor's intent to put up big fences and keep Alaskans out of that land, or can we still walk on it, maybe I think probably manage our forests, hunt moose on it, drive a snow machine through it, or is it going to be completely off limits because we've locked it up, so to speak, for the carbon offsets?
Yeah, Representative McCabe, through the chair, not at all the intent of the governor and not at all the functional language to have any sort of restriction on that kind of access. You know, continued crossing, snow machining, trekking, four-wheeling across these lands is totally appropriate. Doesn't raise any issues with generating the offset revenue. And I'd go a step further. I know it's a significant concern to the legislature for other uses of the land, you know, above and beyond just incidental hunting, fishing, access use. So things like, you know, these kind of projects anticipate some level of timber harvest, forest product development continuing on the land. If you're able to increase growth in an area, you may be even able to increase harvest at the same time through a project that's balanced. And so, you know, we don't see those kind of restrictions at all being part of the legislation. And it's really the intent is to make more use of the lands, not to limit uses.
Well,
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. So just to follow up, so you mentioned forest management, which you know, you and I have talked a little bit about, and which I'm I have studied quite a bit about. Actually, I have a neighbor that owns a sawmill, and they do some forestry work. And it seems to me that the best carbon eaters, if you will, filters of carbon, are growing trees. And if we're going to manage our forests, we're not talking about clear cuts now. We're talking about selectively, maybe up to 20%, selectively cutting trees and regrowing and clearing underbrush. To do that means that we have to build some logging roads, which it seems to me are helpful for firefighting. I know they certainly are in some of the forests in the western U.S. where you have a logging road that you can access a forest fire if you need to. And in fact, if it's a managed forest, the chances of a forest fire are much less. So it seems to me that that would also be one of the governor's intents, is to, you know, we have such a huge problem with fuel, beetle kill spruce in South Central. You know, if we can start to manage our forests and get rid of some of those, the beetle kill will be less, the forest fire chances will be less, and we will have road access, forest roads that the firefighters can get to. It seems to me that's the part of the goal as well, or maybe a secondary or tertiary benefit to this, if I'm not mistaken. That might not have been a question.
I think I can sum the question up in my mind. What is, does this plan, as it's shaping up, include the allowance of roads on state land that currently don't have roads in order to facilitate the management of the forest?
Yeah, Representative McCabe and Chair Carpenter, I think very well said, and potential increased road access is certainly part of these projects. You know, the intent of a carbon offset project for forestation is to increase carbon on the landscape. And so if part of that activity is developing access to do forest thinning, to do reforestation, that's fully consistent potentially with a project, you know. And so we're, you know, the suite of projects that people may bring to the state that we may be able to develop, we're still working to assess all those different ones, but those kind of activities we view as consistent and part of the goal to make the forest landscape, the natural landscape, subject to more use, more carbon, more access, more recreation, more timber products, essentially the win-win-win.
We're about halfway done with the time that we have allotted tonight. I would like to take some time and get through some more of your slides. Representative Gray, I see you have a question. Can you hold it? Thank you. Mr. Crowther, can you continue, please?
Yes, Chair. I'll move quickly out of respect for time here. So this is a very a high-level overview, and I commend the committee the Senate Resources Committee has done some presentations by practitioners in the field about these topics that for folks who want to review those, very good discussion of what all these terms mean. But these are essentially some of the requirements for an offset project to be registered, to generate credits, to, you know, to generate that kind of value that we're looking for. So, you know, it has to be real. It has to do a physical thing on the landscape. That thing has to be measured. It has to be permanent, and not in the sense of it has to last forever, but it has to be permanent on the scale of project goals, 10, 20, 40 years of more carbon on the landscape. It can't be, we had some more carbon, you know, earlier we were talking about, you know, natural processes, carbon leads to more fish growth, but then those fish are consumed. You know, the just like if we had more tree growth, but then all those trees are harvested, that is the permanent part, is that some of that carbon remains in the landscape in a longer term sense. Additionality, that the carbon that's added is associated with the project, not just the status quo. And then, of course, that all these things have to be verified. Third-party registries have developed protocols and standards that assess whether these terms are met. And I'll move forward.
Please do.
So now moving into the CCUS, the geologic sequestration. Similarly, a very simple cartoon to show what's going on in the CCUS project. On the left side, you see the capture. So that's a source of carbon dioxide. Could be a coal power plant, could be an industrial process like producing ammonia. It could be, as referenced by the prior presenter, direct air capture, where essentially carbon dioxide is filtered out of the air. But once that carbon is captured, it's transported, possibly using a pipeline, but in some theoretical sense, people are trying to develop this capacity, even ocean-going tankers. And then it's either used, so that's a beneficial use of carbon. Something like enhanced oil recovery is clearly a very beneficial use of interest to Alaska, but is one of the primary beneficial uses today. But then also storage, where that carbon dioxide is injected underground, maintained in an underground reservoir. Next slide. So this is a lot of words, but I'll give you the high points real quickly. We talked about why now. One of the things from the department's perspective why pursuing CCUS is of interest is that these projects are developing all around the country and the world. And they're developing in other, you know, our peer and our competitor states, Texas, Louisiana, North Dakota, the Middle East, the producing areas of Europe are all looking at CCUS. And so we think as another, as a resource producer, both in the mining side and the oil and gas side, we should be offering these, doing what we can to potentiate these projects in Alaska. Of course, federal incentives, federal legislation is a big part of what's driving those projects in the U.S. especially. So that's the 45Q tax credit, where companies are able to claim a tax credit if they sequester carbon dioxide. And basically, right now, you know, we're seeing billions of dollars of projects sanctioned to pursue these kind of incentives. We want some of those projects sanctioned in Alaska. And so, you know, and at the last point in the slide, what is the potential in Alaska? We know we have tremendous geologic basins for hydrocarbons. Some of those are depleted, so those are a natural place to store carbon dioxide. But as I referenced earlier, probably of much more capacity are things like underground saline aquifers that are essentially geologic traps and structures like oil and gas fields, but they're not charged with petroleum and hydrocarbons. And then also unminable coal seams, so deep, deep coal seams that have similarly the ability to inject and store carbon dioxide. I'll go to the next slide.
Please do.
So this is just a quick, you know, the geologists among you will probably give me a hard time if I expound on this too much because I'm not a geologist, don't have a technical background. But this just shows essentially the things you need for carbon sequestration are very similar to the things you need for oil and gas. And so we're very well positioned for them. On the right side, Kenai Gas Field, showing different hydrocarbon reservoirs indicated in the yellow and red. And then the so each one of those, in theory, could be a sequestration target for carbon dioxide. The tan and then teal-colored are mudstone seals and traps that are keeping those formations separate, keeping the hydrocarbons in them from migrating to the surface. And so if we put carbon dioxide in those reservoirs, we'd expect the same function. On the right side, you see a photomicrograph, pictomicrograph of essentially a cross-section of some of Alaska's subsurface. And that that blue is porosity and permeability, so how a fluid can migrate in an underground reservoir. And though you have to have that so that when you inject carbon dioxide, it is able to travel throughout the reservoir space and fill it up. Just like if you have that porosity and permeability, it allows hydrocarbons to flow out of that space and up a well. So I'll move on to the next slide, unless there's questions.
Please do.
So this is just a very high-level overview from a basin perspective, not necessarily the saline aquifers or unminable coal seams. We have a map for each, but about potential that has been assessed in Alaska. And as you can see there, the Cook Inlet, the North Slope have high known potential, but we also have some potential in the interior and all sorts of potential all around the state. Not that we would expect a project to develop immediately in those areas. They're frontier. They're very remote. They don't have the infrastructure of Cook Inlet, the North Slope, and to some degree the interior. But we have a tremendous potential in Alaska. And that's why the legislation, like the offsets legislation, would open up all these areas, not to speak to it specifically. And I'll move on to the next
slide. Thank you. Please continue.
And so this is where else in the United States is pursuing CCUS. And as I mentioned earlier, you see a lot of our peer states. On the left is a map of states that have the framework legislation, so the regulatory legislation in place for projects to proceed. Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Wyoming, North Dakota, all are competitors from natural resource development, but also West Virginia, Kentucky, states that have coal resources that want to have these CCUS projects available. And on the right side, there's a depiction of the states that are seeking the regulatory authority for the wells needed to inject carbon dioxide. And so same thing, we're seeing our resource peer states pursuing that authority as well to make sure these projects can move forward in a timely fashion. Next slide, just summarizing what we called our CCUS work group that the University of Alaska led over the last year. The Department of Natural Resources participated along with other state agencies, significant participation from industry stakeholders. And also I'd highlight the PCORE, the Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership. That's a organization with hundreds of members, companies we would all recognize, Hillcore is a member, that the University of Alaska recently stepped into a leadership role to convene with the University of North Dakota in Wyoming as a convener for that organization. And so they've been a tremendous resource as we've developed the legislation. And I'll do two slides quickly to close out on why we think, you know, we've covered it in this presentation, but why we think these concepts and these opportunities are good for Alaska. And the first one is a very rough chart here. We see this is from the International Energy Agency, so a statistical service for world resources. And this is a map that it shows that in its scenario where the world is net zero in 2070, so there in it what talks about how there's all these CCUS facilities operating. Today we have 35. To hit this scenario, they have 2,500 facilities that are operating. The thing that I think is interesting as an Alaskan and as working at the Department of Natural Resources is when you look at this chart, you see in 2070, coal, still a major part of the energy mix. Natural gas, major part of the energy mix. Biomass, major part of the energy mix. To me, that says those resources, if these CCUS projects are viable, even if we're in this net zero reality, even if that's achievable, even if that's possible, all that aside, 2070, those natural resources are still valuable. And so from the state's perspective, being a major resource owner, we want as much value as we can out of our resources. And unless there's any questions, I'll go to the next slide. And this is one of the slides we've shown several times, but it speaks to the corporate goals of oil and gas companies that are operating in Alaska. And we view these as essentially clients of our projects, whether CCUS or offsets. These companies are undertaking these activities. They are buying offsets in the market. They are doing CCUS projects in the U.S. and the world, and we want them to do them in Alaska. We also want them to keep doing their oil and gas activities, and we think making carbon management opportunities will allow them to do that and encourage them to increase those investments. Everybody, you know, that's a major operator on the North Slope up on this chart, ConocoPhillips and Exxon, major U.S. companies, but also Santos and Repsol, major European and Australian companies that have just made a major new investment in Alaska. They're all trying to pursue more oil and gas development. We're hoping from the Department of Natural Resources, we're encouraging them to. But part of that is pursuing carbon development in Alaska if we're able to bring these opportunities forward. Sir?
I have a question regarding this slide. I'm going to try to phrase it as delicately as I can. Do these goals represent an altruistic desire, or are they choices that have been made so that business can continue when investment funds are necessary?
Yeah, Representative Carpenter, I believe, I can't speak for any of these companies individually. I can just give my general assessment. And I think that, you know, all of them are in the business of producing energy and generating returns for their shareholders. They're in the business of complying with how their management and their boards of directors direct them to do that. And as you said, or as you referenced, their investment is a precondition for that. Capital providers, as referenced in some of these discussions, if you follow these links or you see the quote from Hillcore, capital providers are saying carbon management is part of providing you an investment. And so for these companies to keep their investment at the levels they have or to increase them, they're coming forward with, as we understand it, coming forward with these goals. And so, you know, as part of achieving these goals, their main value is still going to come from developing energy, selling that energy, and that's going to generate profit for their investors, for their shareholders, and the energy and fuels that consumers are demanding.
From your perspective, has there been any communication to the state from any of the providers or producers that access to financial markets is also tied to state of Alaska policy in regards to net zero goals?
So, Representative Carpenter, if I understand the question, you know, I think these companies are operating from their internal goals. They have a goal or benchmark or target that they feel they need to meet. Now, from their perspective, I don't think they need that to be in a given jurisdiction. I think that from our perspective, from the state's perspective, if we give they're clearly pursuing these opportunities. If we give them in jurisdiction opportunities, they're more likely to pursue those, and that brings that part of the value stream, keeps it here in Alaska. You know, if we have, for instance, just to cite an operator on here, Santos has talked about the Pika project that they've sanctioned, that investment meeting net zero. And that means they're going to be buying offset credits from somewhere in the world. They're going to be sequestering carbon somewhere in the world. And so some of that raw value generated from the sale of the oil that they intend to develop is going to go into carbon management. And we want it to say, you know, the oil, the economic benefit goes into workers in Alaska, the royalty goes into Alaska Treasury, and this carbon tranche stays in Alaska too. That's, you know, we see that as us bringing forward that opportunity. So if that answers your question, sir, I don't think they have demanded it, but I think they view it as incentivizing and allowing their development to continue in Alaska.
Didn't quite answer the question, but I'll think about a way to rephrase it. You can continue with your presentation.
I think that brings us to the end of the presentation, but we do have that additional slide.
Yes. Why don't we go to that? I think we'll take a brief at ease and bring that slide up. Okay, we're back on the record, and we have one additional slide to go over here that I think was briefed earlier today in another committee. Mr. Crowther, can you help us out here?
Yeah, certainly, Chair. I'll give a very high-level overview of this slide, but of course, if there's questions, happy to run through in more detail. So these are three very hypothetical development scenarios for a CCUS project. And so there's all sorts of assumptions in here. We don't, you know, discount these revenues over time as one would for an economic model. You know, the net present value of revenues have to be adjusted through time. We didn't do that. We haven't assessed the likelihood of timelines or the costs associated with these decisions. We just assumed a project of this kind of size and scope is going forward, laid out the general baseline terms of revenue associated with it to give an idea of if a project like this made economic sense and move forward, this is the kind of revenue the state would see. So the first project is a regional power facility. And so that's something I believe in our hypothetical, it produces about 250,000 tons of CO2 a year. And so that's akin to a decent sized power plant, but like the kind we see operating in Alaska today. And so if that power plant moved forward with a CCUS project, in those initial years 1, 2, and 3, there's an exploration license, you know, the right to assess an area for a CCUS project. You have to pay a fee to the state if that's on state land. So that results in, under our hypothetical here, about $300,000. That's, you know, nothing to sneeze at from a state revenue perspective. In years 4 and 5, they're able to essentially move that exploration license, so attempt to characterize, into identifying an area they want to do sequestration in. So they shrink it. They go from that $92,000 of annual rental down to just a, you know, roughly a quarter of it, $25,000 a year. And then in year 5, that's when their power plant, they keep operating their power plant, but then they also do the injection. And that is when there starts to be significant revenue under a per ton of injection fee of I believe, $2.50 in this assumption. And that results in $600,000 a year in revenue, approximately. And so all of this going forward results in about $12 million revenue over 20 years. Again, that's non-discounted, but, you know, that's an in-state power plant, continues to operate. They're able to say, whether it's to in-state Alaskans or to their investors or capital providers, you know, that are providing funds to keep that power plant running, this has reduced carbon emissions. The state makes $12 million. You know, we think that's a decent scenario. I just would explain for the committee, reduced pollution charges there. That's in the event that putting in the technology to do the carbon sequestration results in the reduction of other pollutants. So sulfur, nitric oxides, carbon monoxide, methane, things that are regulated currently by the Department of Environmental Conservation and assessed a fee if they're emitted. So there might be, very hypothetical, a small reduction in those, and so less pollution, and so less fee income to DEC there. On the hypothetical number 2, that's what could essentially be assumed to be a gas treatment plant on the North Slope for existing operations. So Prudhoe Bay today expends a tremendous amount of energy through natural gas to, you know, run all of its operations, including the massive compressors to inject methane and continue to cycle that to promote oil recovery. And so that project would essentially be the same thing as project number 1, having an exploration license to assess an area, so a few $100,000 in revenue, paring that down into the area that the operator would want to inject into, and then moving into injection. So that's when, again, $2.5 million per year of state income. So I would note in this example, we assumed some of that concentrated carbon dioxide would go into enhanced oil recovery and some would go into storage. And so from the state's perspective, royalty oil owner, enhanced oil recovery means more royalty oil for us. And so that's why you see the real benefit of that hypothetical is that enhanced oil value in our example, over $8 million a year once injection begins. And so the total value to the state, not discounted, over $200 million over 20 years. And then hypothetical 3 is the most removed from the world we see today, but a potential of where these markets could be going. And that's where there's the import of carbon dioxide from places like Japan, Korea, into Alaska, because we have more potential places to put it than we have emissions that come from Alaska. And so the order of magnitude on those items is just a whole scale bigger in terms of revenue at the exploration and development licensing phase. And then that injection fee, $25 million a year, and potentially a much longer project life, 40 years. And so that's, you see a number of $1 billion in revenue for that facility. And that's revenue that's coming into Alaska. Other people's carbon from coming around the world. We're not having to do anything different in state except for taking carbon and take the payments. So I think that's a quick summary there, but there certainly may be questions.
Representative Gray, how did I know you were going to have a question?
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, I want to go back and talk a little bit about trees for a second. From Representative McCabe's questions about putting in the roads and managing them, is there any room for us to get carbon credits for acres of trees that we don't actually build roads around and manage? I mean, is there a market for us to sell acres of land that we don't really have access to?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I don't want to speak too definitively about what we may or may not be able to develop. You know, as we talk to project developers, all of those things, you know, road access, prior significant harvest, they make projects more valuable, but they're not inherently or necessarily the only way to have a project. And so really what we want to do is make these lands available. And if people come forward with projects, we want to offer them the opportunity to do so and for the state to benefit. And in some areas that either don't have any access or don't have certain kinds of forestation or, you know, have other conditions, projects may not come forward and, you know, nothing ventured, but nothing gained. If those projects, if people do figure out a way to sequester more carbon on that landscape and generate some revenue, we think that's terrific. But, you know, that is a challenge for projects as we understand it, but we don't know definitively where that tipping point is.
Follow up.
Well, I was going to say, because I think that's the part that's hard for me to wrap my head around, is that we could potentially get paid to not cut down trees that we weren't going to cut down anyway. And I mean, I guess that's where it comes in, is that we need to threaten to cut them down if we want to get paid not to cut them down. Is that? We need to threaten to cut them down so that we can be paid not to cut them down. No?
I don't think so.
So Representative Gray, through the chair, you know, I think it is fair to say that areas that have all of the precursors for active and heavy harvest and that have historically seen heavy harvest, you can very, very credibly say, well, if we're not doing a harvest this year or this 5 years, that's a big change.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one of the things that these projects we hope to draw out is an area where, you know, and there may be projects where people say, well, you have the legal right to harvest these trees, even though it seems unlikely, there's still some credits to be gained. You know, we'll monetize that. If that project is in the market and people are paying for it, we want to offer that too. What we're hoping longer term is that people say, there's an area without a lot of roads, without a lot of activity, with maybe without a lot of growth, there's enough new energy in the system to justify putting a road in, justify doing reforestation, and taking more forest timber products out. Not going to be everywhere, not going to be automatic, but that's kind of the vision and hope, is that this allowing carbon offsets on state lands puts another side on the plus column for, does a road make sense to put in? Does a reforestation project pencil out? That's, you know, something that hasn't been in the plus column historically. So if project proponents say that those kind of projects just aren't viable, then we won't see them.
Are there any projects that have been conducted within the state of Alaska, maybe outside of the state, and as an entity?
So Representative Carpenter, or Chair Carpenter, we've seen Alaska Native corporations have done significant numbers of projects in Alaska and brought in credits to the order of hundreds of millions of dollars, if not potentially more. Many of those were done in the California Resources Board regulated market, but not all of them. And so we've seen Alaska Native corporations use lands, some of them subject to historical harvest, some of them very accessible, but also some of them, you know, the scale that they've done, large projects that don't have, you know, immediate access all throughout the blocks. And those projects have been on the market, and we understand been successful too. And so, you know, it's a developing space. But we understand that part of that market growth is people looking at these kinds of, you know, what does a bigger project look like? What is a different or expanded definition of this kind of consideration look like? So that's why we want to get into the space.
And I know those are private entities. Any idea what the earnings potential or the earnings realized for those entities compared to a projection that we're making on paper?
Yeah, so we can really only speculate, and you know, I think the path through that speculation has been the number of credits that are generated, and oftentimes are in registries, and that's a public piece of information, how many credits a given project has or is generating. And so you can extrapolate, you know, if you take the current value of a credit times the number generated, the value is this. So that's where that number that has been publicly discussed of hundreds of millions of dollars comes from, because the number of credits times the, you know, average prevailing value of credits at the different times the projects were generated very easily add up to hundreds of millions. I guess I would say that those markets are somewhat volatile. You know, the price of a credit goes up and down. But, you know, if those growth extrapolations that we've seen from consultants are true in the voluntary market, you know, there may not be. They may come slower. They may come faster. But if those growth, you know, projections come true, credit prices are either going to go up or there's going to be more credits to meet that volume. So,
Representative Gray, did you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you so much, Chair. So I want to ask about CCUS now. Coming out of this idea that we might be able to get paid to not cut down trees that we weren't going to cut down anyway, I kind of have the ultimate CCUS. Is it possible under some circumstance for us to get paid not to take oil out of the ground? And my brief sort of crazy idea is just if we did it like a GoFundMe, there's so many environmentalists around the world that we could potentially set up a charge to get to fund our government to be paid not to drill oil. If we had people, we had like $100 billion in the ground and we divided up, you know, how much that would be over time, that we could potentially get to paid not to drill. Do people talk about that? Is that possible?
So Representative Gray, through the chair, I don't think we've heard those kinds of proposals. You know, from our perspective in the department, you know, one on the CCUS bill doesn't really enable that kind of project. You know, the other thing is we have an obligation for maximum value, maximum development. And so, you know, that would be hard to square, you know, developing and utilizing those oil resources with not doing so explicitly. But that really, we haven't contemplated that as part of the legislation.
Follow up.
Follow up.
We'd still have the oil in the ground.
Thanks.
Representative McCabe, you have a question.
I do have a question that's actually might. Anyway, so it occurs to me in scenario one and scenario two there, that there's a missing line maybe, and it's the line that would show the expense to say the power company, if we don't do this, how much is our power going to increase because they have to ship it out, the CO2 out somewhere. So it just seems to me that there's sort of a hidden cost to the consumer in there for scenario one of a company that wants to be a good steward of the environment, wants to capture the carbon, whether it's voluntary or whether it's comes from a financer, whatever it is, they want to capture the carbon, and now they're going to have to ship it out of state to just like much like Korea and Japan and would do to shipping theirs to us. We're going to have to ship it to West Virginia, say, because their legislature actually put a framework in place. And that's going to add a cost that they're obviously going to pass on to the consumer, us. It just seemed to me that there's a hidden cost of not doing this close. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yeah, Representative McCabe, I think I see what you're saying. I think it's a very good point. We don't, from this legislation, have any requirement to do this, so that, you know, a consumer wouldn't bear the cost of requiring to do it. But I think it's very fair to say, you know, right now in Alaska, I mean, this is, I'm going to get close to the line here, but right now in Alaska, we have a lot of coal resources. Why aren't we using them? And one of the answers to that may be it's very hard to attract the investment to develop the resource itself or to commit to a long-term power plant investment when carbon dioxide is ever present on these investors and the, you know, developers and, you know, the different utility leadership teams that are trying to do a power mix. And so if we offer, you know, the cost that the consumer bears in that case is foregoing that kind of access to reliable power. So if we're able to offer a method to reduce or eliminate carbon emissions associated with using our resources that are in state, that might be very fairly said to be a consumer benefit. And so I think, you know, as I said, this legislation doesn't make that requirement. There's a lot of complicated decisions around what resources we use to provide energy. But, you know, whether it's natural gas, whether it's coal, whether it's oil, carbon management helps the investment case, you know, and helps the development case for all of them, we think.
Thanks.
I don't see any other questions. Do you have anything else for your presentation?
I'll spare the committee. I think I'm over time.
Okay. I think we're pushing 8 o'clock right now, so it was a perfect timing. Thank you, both of you, for coming and presenting this information to us and answering the questions. It was surely enlightening for me. I think this concludes our business for today, if I don't have any other questions. Next Wednesday, we're going to take up the topic of the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend. Ought to be an interesting conversation. Seeing no other business for the committee, we will be adjourned at 8 p.m. Thank you.